Well, I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash, and we're building bridges to listeners over WBAI, over WPFW, and over radio and internet stations across the country.
The right to self-determination or the devastation and destruction of conquest. Why and how the U.S. supports Morocco's forced annexation of Western Sahara and is silent about the atrocities committed against these people.
Stephen Zunis is teaching in the Peace and Justice Studies Program, the International Studies Department, and the Middle Eastern Studies Program, for which he is the founding director. And Jacob Mundy teaches in the Peace and Conflict Studies Program and the Middle East and Islamic Studies Program at Colgate University. And they are co-authors of Western Sahara War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. And that's what we're going to be talking about. And I want to thank you both for being with us, people who are extraordinarily knowledgeable on the issue of Western Sahara. And I want to begin by talking about the U.S. failure under both Republican and Democratic administrations to uphold the fundamental principles of international law being challenged in this remote region of northwestern Africa, Western Sahara, i.e. the forcible annexation by Morocco. Where in the world is the U.S.? Why has it been silent about the annexation and the atrocities committed against the Sahrawi people? And thank you both for joining us.
I mean, fortunately, the answer to your question is one that's very familiar to those of us who have followed and critiqued U.S. foreign policy for years. On the one hand, we stand up for these values enshrined in the United Nations Charter, which the United States actually played a major role in writing back in 1945, that prohibits countries from expanding their territory by force, that gives the right of self-determination to nations emerging from colonization and the like. But we've look the other way when allies violate these principles, similarly with their double standards on human rights and quite a few other things. But Western Sahara is particularly flagrant because the United States is virtually the only country in the war that has formally recognized Morocco's annexation of this territory, ironically right at the time when we are trying to take leadership in the international community against Russian attempts to expand their territory by force.
Jacob?
I don't have anything to add. I think that summarizes the situation very clearly. If we think about the most fundamental violations of international law, which is the crime of aggression, there have been two really outstanding cases in the international system, prolonged, protracted, egregious, and that's Palestine and Western Sahara. And when you look at the U.S. policy on both cases, there's really not much you could say except that there's at least a consistent inconsistency when it comes to these sorts of conflicts.
And I want you to kind of draw this out. The implications of the Biden administration's policy really go well beyond the fate of the 500,000 Sahrawis that are living in exile or under repressive military rule. Talk more about that, and I'm still trying to grapple with the kind of hypocrisy and contradiction of the Biden administration in terms of the way that it's not dealing with, or dealing with as the case may be, supporting the annexation by Morocco of Western Sahara. I mean, how are we supposed to understand that in relationship to, Stephen, what you pointed out, the positioning that they're presumably taking in Ukraine, which is for self-determination, the respect of international borders and the like?
And start off, of course, by noting that these are not white people like Ukrainians are, that these are an Arab African people who've struggled for self-determination for many years. Their nation, Western Sahara, which is formerly known as the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, has been recognized at one time or another by over 80 countries. They're a full member state of the African Union. What the Biden administration essentially is doing is recognizing the takeover of one sovereign recognized African state by another, which of course have gotten many African countries upset at us. What's really at stake here is what do we stand for, the right of self-determination or the right of conquest? And this is a brutal conquest. I mean, the repression by the Moroccans is horrific. Freedom House, which if anything has something of a pro-Western bias in its quantitative study of relative human rights abuses, says that out of 210 nations surveyed, Western Sahara, Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara, is 209th in terms of political rights. Only Syria is worse. And yet the United States is insisting that the people of Western Sahara accept this so-called autonomy plan that the Moroccans are pushing, which doesn't come close to meeting the international definition of autonomy, which denies them the right of self-determination. And if they got away with this would be the first incomplete decolonization of its kind. And so that's why it's really a dangerous precedent. I mean, if Morocco gets away with this, it would be the first time since the signing of the United Nations Charter that the international community recognizes a country expanding its territory by force and denying a former colony its right of self-determination. This is why I've gotten involved with this. I mean, obviously, I care about the people of Western Sahara, but I also care about the foundations of international law, the very principle we supposedly fought the Gulf War about, the principle that we supposedly are defending Ukraine about.
Let's go back now and perhaps examine the origins, the evolution of the conflict and the resilience of the Western Saharan people in this, which I know women play a major role in. Jacob, why don't you take us there?
Western Sahara was a colony of Spain. It was kind of an aberration, a region that was more or less dominated by the French. The Spanish weren't really interested in the Western Sahara. Mainly what they wanted was protection for their interests in the Canary Islands, which were off the coast of Western Sahara. So it was more or less a neglected colony for several decades, and really became interesting to the Spanish after World War II, when very rich phosphate reserves began to be developed. Spain even used the colonial tactic that the French had used, which was to try to annex the territory as an overseas province. And it was administered as a fully incorporated province of Spain up until the mid-1970s, when international pressure to decolonize, to hold a referendum, and even, if you look in UN General Assembly resolutions, to give the territory outright independence, which is actually the default way in which most territories achieved self-determination. In 1974, Spain announced that it was going to decolonized through a vote on independence. And this triggered a Moroccan reaction, where Morocco requested an opinion of the International Court of Justice in order to stop Spain from handing the territory to the Sahrawis. Morocco wanted to reincorporate, as from their point of view, Western Sahara into a very expanded territorial vision of Morocco that has barely existed at any time throughout their history. And the International Court of Justice came back with an opinion that was utterly clear that Morocco had no demonstrated historical links to the territory, and that even if they had, it doesn't matter because decolonization law says that the people get to choose their fate. So in order to prevent this, Morocco effectively invaded the territory in 1975. And as we know from the diplomatic record and the statements of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, that the United States worked behind the scenes to make sure that Morocco got the territory, mainly because the United States was very afraid that if Morocco failed to get the territory, that they would lose a Cold War ally.
Can you tell us more about the people of Western Sahara? You mentioned that one of the major industries is phosphate. I don't know exactly how big that is, but what kind of work do they do? Just give us a picture of the people of Western Sahara.
Well, primarily the nomadic population up until colonization. And then as happened with a lot of places around the world, urbanization was more or less fairly rapid once cities began to be built and lifestyles changed. But the Sahrawis had various kinds of lifestyles. There were coastal tribes that engaged in fishing. There were wide-ranging nomadic tribes covering parts of Algeria all the way to northern Mali and Mauritania. But in terms of national identity, what's really important is the use of a different dialect of Arabic that isn't spoken in most of Morocco. It's more from familiar to Mauritanian speakers of Arabic. The kinship systems and the traditions are entirely unique to the region. They're not part of Morocco's cultural heritage. And in addition to that, there's a very strong sense of national identity that has developed not only in these refugee camps, where about 40% of the population has had to live since 1976, but in the territory under Moroccan occupation, that we've only seen the nationalist impulses of the Sahrawi people increase in recent years. And as was sort of mentioned, gender relations are quite extraordinary when compared to the rest of the Arab world, and particularly Morocco. Sahrawi women hold a very powerful position within society. They never had to veil. They have the right of divorce. They are in charge of many of the, not only the cultural aspects of Sahrawi society, but social, economic, and political forces as well. We see within the national independence movement, we've seen Sahrawi women demand incorporation into the armed forces. Sahrawi women more or less organized the refugee camps and ran them during the war from 1975 to 1991. And today we see Sahrawi women not only as prominent actors within the independence movement and the state in exile, Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, but also among the nonviolent resistance movement inside the occupied territory, where they day by day protest Morocco's brutal occupation. The most famous is currently is Sultana Khaya, who's suffered under house arrest for months and suffered sexual abuse. And nonetheless, she persists and continues to protest the Moroccan occupation.
And is she part of Polisario? And can you tell us more about the Polisario Front and the fight back that continues all these years against this forced annexation?
Well, she certainly would identify as a nationalist, pro-independence Sahrawi. I'm sure Polisario would allow her to join. But unfortunately, because of the Morocco's occupation, the population has been divided since 1975-76, that, as I mentioned, 40% were forced to flee into exile and have lived in Algeria in these refugee camps. And that's where the Polisario independence movement has its basically its headquarters today. Now, there are clandestine cells inside the occupied territory. There are ways in which the activists in the occupied territory liaise and interface with Polisario, but Polisario is more an expression of an ideal, and that's Sahrawi nationalism, Sahrawi independence. In that sense, many Sahrawis are members of Polisario, or at least agree with the ideal of independent statehood.
I think what's important about this really is that it underscores that while the precise boundaries of Western Sahara are somewhat arbitrary, that it is indeed a distinct nation. And even putting aside the legal arguments for independence, that this is, you know, these people are not Moroccans, and they'll never be Moroccans, no matter how much the occupation forces try to rewrite their history and their education system and the like, and no matter how many colonists that they bring in. I mean, currently Moroccan settlers actually outnumber by 3-1 the indigenous population within the territories. It's probably more like 3-2 if you count the refugee population. But these distinctions are important. I mean, the fact that women are in leadership, the Moroccans see the Sahrawi women as uppity or whatever, and as therefore they're targeted for particularly a serious harassment. Another leader, another woman who's in the leadership there is Aminatou Haidar, who's won the Right Livelihood Award, the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award. She's been nominated multiple times for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's known as the Saharan Gandhi for her commitment to nonviolent resistance. And yet, here in the United States, the idea of an Arab nationalist movement led by a Muslim woman committed to nonviolence, I mean, that doesn't quite fit into our paradigm about what we think of the Arab Islamic world. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that people haven't heard more about it.
I wonder if you can also talk more about, I keep going back to the Biden administration's apparent belief that Western Sahara should be governed by a a foreign autocratic right-wing monarchy instead of a relatively progressive and secular republic says a lot about its priorities. So what are the lessons that we can learn? And tell us more about how dire is the situation and how oppressive of the people of Western Sahara under the forced rule of Morocco.
It is indeed ironic that to have an have a country governed in the way that the Western Saharans would like to govern themselves is being discouraged at the time we are justifying military intervention in the Middle East in the name of promoting democracy and the like. What is, I mean, I have been to probably 85 countries at this point, including Iraq under Saddam and Indonesia under Suharto, and I've never seen a worse police state. I mean, what's interesting about this is that people who have been to Western Sahara, even people who are ideologically quite conservative and are dedicated to American empire, and this include the likes of John Bolton and Frank Ruddy and people of this nature, when they see what's going on, they suddenly become these big supporters of Western Sahara independence because they recognize the brutality of what's going on, and they question why is the United States supporting this kind of brutality. I mean, what's interesting, if you look at the U.S. Senate, the two biggest proponents of Western Sahara self-determination are prominent liberals like, from Vermont.
Leahy.
Sanders,
Patrick
Leahy. Patrick Leahy, and on the other end, Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, one of the most conservative people. Yet the foreign policy establishment in both the Republican and Democratic administrations seems to be dedicated to continuing our love affair with these monarchies, which include, of course, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and other repressive regimes.
You also mentioned the Palestinians before. This would seem to be even on a grander scale than the Israelis in their occupied territories, the Moroccans that have been colonizing Western Sahara with, many, many tens of thousands of settlers. That's the other thing that's going on. Talk about that as well.
I think the important difference is that whereas Israel is creating very clearly an apartheid regime, one of, social apartheid, economic, political, geographical apartheid, right, to drive these distinctions between, territories that are quote-unquote Palestinian and quote-unquote Israeli. Morocco's effort in Western Sahara is intensively colonial in the sense of, all of the political systems, the economic systems, the infrastructural systems. Morocco wants you to think that, that there is no distinction between Morocco and Western Sahara, that there's that there's no border, there's no sense in which you've transitioned somewhere, right? They want you to think that this is a part of Morocco. And part of this takes place in the sense of not erasure of Sahrawi culture, but the cynical weaponization of it by Morocco, whether it's, tourist festivals or various things of that sort, holding international conferences in Western Sahara and bringing out Moroccans dressed as Sahrawis for the media and things of that sort. So it's very much a colonial occupation regime, but it's more of one of total integration, right? A kind of totalizing occupation rather than one which, in Palestine, where you have these sort of micro dynamics of separation.
It would also seem that one of the things we're also, while we talk much about who's a war criminal and international law, and of course we're not even a member of the International Criminal Court, but all of this would seem to be out of step with international law, and I want you to talk more about that, and certainly, from the United Nations and the World Court and the African Union, their positions on this. Please talk about that.
This is, Stephen, I agree that this is the one area that where I think we see the greatest hope for Western Sahara is in the domain of international law, where repeatedly we get these very clear statements that Western Sahara is not a part of Morocco, that the people have been denied self-determination, that they have a right to statehood. So beginning with the UN General Assembly resolutions in the 1960s up to the International Court of Justice in 1975, an opinion that was utterly reaffirmed in the 2002 legal opinion of the highest legal body in the UN. And recently, the European Court of Justice has handed down three rulings that have invalidated European Union efforts to have a trade agreement with Morocco that involves goods from Western Sahara. The most recent has even pushed further, is basically the establishment of Western Saharan personhood under international law, which could eventually allow Polisario to bring more and more cases in international legal fora against Morocco, possibly maybe down the road, the crime of aggression, which was recently recognized by the International Criminal Court as a prosecutable crime. The African Union has maintained the exact position of the Organization of African Unity, which is that Western Sahara is a full member state of that organization and should be given all the rights of a fully recognized member state. And recently, cases in even South Africa and Panama, we've seen Western Sahara nationalists successfully pursue Morocco's illegal exploitation of the natural resources, particularly the phosphates. So international law is one of the trains where there's actually a lot of reason to be hopeful.
Unfortunately, of course, the United States has been quite hypocritical in these regard. I mean, if you look at maps, for example, from the United Nations, from Rand McNally, from National Geographic, from Google, Morocco and Western Sahara are separate countries. But on all U.S. government maps, all Morocco, no demarcation whatsoever. And the State Department sees Western Sahara as part of Morocco, no distinction. But I think the fact that the United States is such an outlier is something that I think gives us leverage. I mean, we think about East Timor, which is another case of the late decolonization and the powerful neighbor invades and swallows it up. The United Nations, of course, says this is illegal, but the United States it blocks the UN from actually doing anything about it because he wanted to help the right-wing dictatorship that we supported in this regard. And it seemed like a hopeless cause. I mean, 25 years ago, it just seemed, no way. This is the triumph of realpolitik. And yet global civil society organized and mobilized and pressured and essentially embarrassed Indonesia's backers, United States, Australia, Britain, that how can you even claim to support these international legal principles if you're supporting Indonesia's occupation? And this is really the real hope that I have on Western Sahara, because militarily the Polisario is not going to win. Guerrilla warfare in open desert, given all the arms that France, the United States, and others give Morocco, they can't win militarily. The nonviolent resistance is very impressive, but when you're outnumbered 3-1 in your own country, there are limits to what nonviolent action can do, and I'm someone who's generally very supportive of recognizing its power. The diplomatic route is at a dead end because Morocco refuses to compromise at all, and the U.S. is preventing the United Nations from pressuring them to compromise. So really, it's the global civil society here that holds the key, as it did in terms of East Timor, as it did in terms of Namibia, in South Africa apartheid itself. That combined with the indigenous resistance and the refusal to assimilate. It's up to ordinary people around the world, particularly here in the United States, given our support, the key role that Washington plays in maintaining the occupation, to raise this issue and press our representatives and people in government around this, to encourage boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, targeting the Moroccan occupation and companies that profit from it. It's really comes down to us, I think.
And what do you say when the U.S. says, which it does, like around Palestine and so on, that let the two parties work it out between themselves, even as the occupying power categorically rules out the option of a viable independent state? So what's the final response to that? And just emphasize where you think people who support the self-determination of Western Sahara. What is it that we need to say and do to make this issue have a greater currency and to stand out in contrast to the position that we are taking in Ukraine, which would deny that we are deeply involved and a major upholder of a war against an African people?
Stephen?
I really do think that there is first of all, just getting people to know about this. I mean, I think that, and that's why I really appreciate you having us on this show. I think it would be great if the people in the BDS movement targeting the Israeli occupation would include Western Sahara in their struggle. In part, both because the Sahrawis deserve it, the attention as much as the Palestinians, whose struggle I also support, of course. But also, it would shield them from this accusation they're unfairly singling out the world's only Jewish state. And I think it would also be important to support efforts in Congress that are trying to restrict U.S. support. We thought we had a great breakthrough just a few weeks ago when Congress said that limited U.S. military cooperation with the Moroccan armed forces until the State Department could certify that that Morocco was taking steps towards a peaceful settlement that recognized the aspirations of the people of the region. But the Biden people just said, oh, yeah, they're doing that. This autonomy agreement, sure, go ahead. I mean, it's kind of like reminds me of when Congress put restrictions in aid to El Salvador on human rights grounds, and the Reagan administration just said, oh, yeah, human rights are improving, even though they're going in the opposite direction. But I think basically we just need to raise hell. Do what we did on East Timor. Do what we did on Central America, on South Africa, what we're doing on Palestine. You know, make it an issue that they have to respond to. Because, you know, I think more than most issues is a pretty clear right and wrong. And the main thing that they have is that nobody's heard of this conflict. And if people knew about the conflict, they'd be under immense pressure to change policy.
Well, Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution by Stephen Zunis and Jacob Munday. It really is the definitive book on Western Sahara, and it has to become a definitive issue for people who believe in equal rights and justice. No more wars, indeed, and self-determination. That's what we believe in. That's what we support. Stephen Zunis, Jacob Munday, thank you so much for the work you do and for alerting us and educating, agitating, and organizing us for a free and independent Western Sahara. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And we are Building Bridges.